Hello and welcome into the season-ending edition of the Golf Show Podcast with Rex and Lav. And folks, we've made it to the finish line. It's been a great year on the channel, well over 100 episodes. But Rex, let's go out with a bang. We're going to start with our top five newsmakers of 2025 in order before doing some awards and a look ahead to next year. And so our number five biggest storyline of the year, drumroll please, is LIV Golf. And Rex, there's a lot of different directions you can go with this. The deal that fell apart between the PIF and the PGA Tour, the move to 72 holes, the majorless year for the top players. Where do you want to start?
I think I would start at the idea that the fact it's number five in the last, what, 3 or 4 years, if we were doing this in December, it probably would have been two at the lowest. One, I'm guessing in 2022 and 2023 when this was at its height. So I think the fact it slipped to fifth is sort of indicative of where we are in the game of golf right now, that it's still background noise, that it's still distracting, that it's still there and it's not going away. But there are other things, as this list indicates, at least four other things that are more important than this. I will say this is the fourth season of LIV Golf. It started in 2022 with an abbreviated schedule. And I'm not quite sure whiteboarding has become sort of the phrase in PGA Tour professional golf right now. I'm not quite sure when they whiteboarded this, that the idea was, okay, in our fourth year, if we can just land Victor Perez and Laurie Cantor, then we'll be okay. This is no disrespect to Laurie Cantor or Victor Perez, both really good players with PGA Tour cards. But the idea that that's where they've landed is fascinating to me. And we should rewind to the idea that you're right. There was not one, but two meetings between the Public Investment Fund of Saudi Arabia and the PGA Tour in the White House with the president of the United States, and they couldn't get a deal done, and they haven't spoken since this. That was before the spring. So it's very much a standoff. It's a stalemate. We don't know what comes next, but clearly the move to 72 holes was part of an effort to get world ranking points, and that would change the narrative a little bit, but I'm still not quite sure what the end game is here because it doesn't seem to resonate in the United States. They seem to have some pretty good footholds internationally, but there still is no clear path forward of how they can not just become relevant, but profitable.
I don't want to gloss over this because I want to go back to February 16th because Tiger Woods, Adam Scott, among others, met with President Trump at the White House. A few days later, Tiger Woods goes on the CBS telecast and says, quote, things are going to heal quickly, before later going on and saying that fans want all of the top players together, not just the people, not just the players on the PGA Tour to play together, all of the top players, and quote, we are going to make that happen. Spoiler alert, that did not happen. In various reporting by you and others suggest it was actually a disastrous meeting. And the consistent theme that we have heard coming out of that is that the tour was and is struggling to find a way to incorporate the team element that, if you listen to PIF chairman Yasir Al-Rumayyan, is so important to him for the future of professional golf. Like, he is absolutely not budging on that. And so the deal broke off and they seem to be going their separate ways. And now with Brian Rolapp on the PGA Tour side and Scott O'Neill on the LIV side, trying to maximize their own products. My question to you would be, how do you view those two products as we sit here at the end of 2025, again, more than 2 years removed from the framework agreement that was supposed to bring those two sides together?
Well, first off, I think you touched on a really important point about those two meetings in the White House. By all accounts, sort of the deal breaker here, the one thing that neither side could come to terms with, the idea is that the Public Investment Fund believes that team golf is the future of professional golf. They weren't going to bend on that. And the idea was the PGA Tour could not see a way to make that model work, at least not in the iteration that we see right now with LIV Golf. That, as I think you brought up a few weeks ago, doesn't seem to be the point anymore. If they're willing to go to 72 holes after essentially naming your tour 54 holes, then maybe it's not a bridge too far. Then maybe they can get to the idea that team golf could be an element, not the element of the competition, but the actual 72 holes of individual stroke play that is the standard in professional golf could be the main part. Maybe that's, I don't know, a crack in the door. Maybe that's a light at the end of the tunnel. But by all accounts, that would seem to be the non-starter. They weren't going to budge on that one. To your point, no, I don't see, at least in the United States, and maybe that's not where they want to draw that final line, but the majority of their events are in the United States, and they still don't seem to have the traction that you would imagine a startup would have after 4 years. They still don't have the reach. They still don't have the eyeballs that you would want to have after 4 years and that much money invested. So maybe there is a 10-year plan. Maybe they did whiteboard this out and they have a bigger and better idea. But as of right now, it's hard to see that.
Yeah, look, I look at the PGA Tour and they have retained most of the best players in the world. They are at least in the process of understanding their weaknesses and actively trying to address them, most particularly by optimizing the tour schedule. When I look at LIV, there almost seems to be like an identity crisis, right? Like if they're shifting away from one of their core tenets of the league, which was 54 holes, as you mentioned, like maybe the team component's next. Maybe CEO Scott O'Neill looks at this, he doesn't see enough progress on the franchise front, and completely punts it. The fact that they went away from 54 holes to begin with, to me at least, suggests that everything should be on the table. And maybe instead of trying to dominate the world of golf with team golf, maybe they take on the DP World Tour, the European Tour, and try to become the preeminent spot to play around the world. Maybe that is sort of the future there. I do think that the move to 54 holes signals to me, you move away from that, signals to me a desire to be among the established golf ecosystem. It does feel more legitimate. You have more teams, you have more players, you have more holes. When you have more holes, the best players, i.e. Jon Rahm, tend to rise to the top. I do think I'm more interested in watching them because I do think it's going to feel like a more legitimate golf tournament in 2026.
I would circle back around and just correct you on one front. You're right. The PGA Tour seems to have the best players in the world. I would still contend that LIV Golf probably has the most popular player in the world, at least as far as social media is concerned, in Bryson DeChambeau. So they still have plenty of traction. And I believe there might be a bit of a change in the philosophy at LIV Golf and how they want to acquire their talent. Instead of going after big ticket items like a Jon Rahm, when you're signing really, really big checks, it seems to me like they've diverted to what a lot of experts thought early in the days they should have done to begin with. The idea that if you start picking off the young players, the players who are coming out of college, the young players coming from Europe, you essentially cut off the PGA Tour supply of talent. You cut off the PGA Tour supply of new blood, which is so important in professional golf. That might be the element that not necessarily makes them relevant, but makes them able to sustain over the next 5 years, because I don't know how you get through the next 5 years if the price tag is going to be $5 billion again.
Yeah. Jose Le Ballester, Tom McKibben, David Pooge, there's certainly a Caleb Surratt. They're certainly accumulating enough young talent that makes me more interested. Again, with the move to 72 holes, I think it could be even more interesting that way with other pathways into the major championships. All right. Our number four newsmaker is Keegan Bradley. And certainly, Rex, this was a way for us to get the Ryder Cup into the conversation as a top newsmaker of the year, but also the will he or won't he drama that consumed much of the spring and the summer in regards to Keegan Bradley's playing captaincy and the status of that, I certainly think was worthy of a spot on our list. How will you remember Keegan's 2025?
I hate to be the guy sitting on the couch on Monday morning questioning all the decisions, but maybe this should be a segment, a note about Luke Donald, because I think you and I can both agree that one of the most brilliant captains, not just for the European team, but for anybody in the Ryder Cup, but he's probably going to get a third turn at it in Ireland in 2 years ago. And I don't want to skip past the idea that he's brilliant. He's pulled all the right levers. Oh, yeah. He's done all the things correctly. Keegan, however, to your point, was so much more fascinating because let's rewind a little bit. And I'm at the Hero World Challenge in the Bahamas this week. And Keegan spoke like he has a little bit since the Ryder Cup about how painful this was. Quote unquote, darkest time of my life is what he said. That's a direct quote. Another quote that actually is more interesting to me is I'd love to avenge that loss, which means I'd love to do it again. That to me makes no sense whatsoever. If this is the darkest time in your life, why would you want to put yourself through this again? But it's clear he is the most tragic of heroes in this scenario because he was really put in an impossible position. He was clearly a plan B for the PGA of America. Tiger Woods drug his feet a little bit. It was clearly going to be his captaincy at Bethpage. And by the time Tiger decided that, nope, I can't do this, I have other things in my life I need to focus on, specifically the PGA Tour and the transition to a new schedule and sort of a new reality in professional golf, the PGA of America had to go somewhere. And this was very much an out-of-the-box idea. Like, let's pick Keegan Bradley. I don't think anybody in the game was anticipating that announcement. He really wasn't on anybody's radar, but they wanted to try to do something different. That in itself is not something that I think you should criticize, because I think outside the box thinking is exactly what the U.S. team needs right now. The criticism comes in the idea that Keegan is very much still a competitor. He is still very much the type of player that could make a team, like he should have made this team. And there's a lot of second guessing, and there's a lot of Monday morning quarterbacking, as I said, but he clearly should have been a player, not a captain on that team. And I say that only because I kept arguing, and I would still argue, he was obviously one of the top 12 Americans going into that Ryder Cup at Bethpage. I'm not quite sure he could have made a difference. I don't think Keegan's the one that's pushing the American team over the top, but it would not have hurt. And then the opposite side of it, you put him in a position where, whether if he wanted to or not, his attention was distracted. He wasn't able to focus, at least leading into the Ryder Cup, the way he wanted to. Talking with him at the Tour Championship was essentially that 11th hour cutoff, when he essentially had to make that decision. Am I going to play? Am I going to captain? He was so tortured and so broken over the idea that, I don't know what to do. I'm never going to get another chance to captain again, was sort of the idea. And he's not sure if he's ever going to get a chance to play again. It was an impossible position, and you can pick apart so many of his decisions as a captain. We can sit here and go through golf course setup and pairings and captain's picks. That's fine. That's what we normally do. But this goes beyond that. You put him in a position where almost failure was the only option.
Yeah, and look, I've been pretty clear about this over the past couple of months. I give Keegan Bradley a monsoon of credit, to use one of your favorite phrases, for compartmentalizing these two parts of his life. Again, for a job that he did not want. Did he want to do it eventually? Sure. Did he want to do it at that stage of his career, about 15 months before the Ryder Cup was going to be played, when he was still a top 20 player in the world? Absolutely not. He said it took him by complete surprise, one of the biggest surprises he could have ever been thrown in his entire life. And yet, I think all of us expected, well, you know, you look at what the precedent is for this, and the sitting U.S. Ryder Cup captain typically falls off a cliff playing-wise, competition-wise, because they're just too distracted. So for Keegan Bradley to put himself even in position to make his own team was seemingly unfathomable. Winning a signature event, the Travelers Championship, was unbelievable, sitting for almost the entirety of the year inside the top 12 in the U.S. Ryder Cup point standings was unbelievable. To me, it is still one of the most selfless acts we've ever seen in the Ryder Cup, in passing over himself, who was 11th in points at the time. But Keegan Bradley, understanding the team dynamic, understanding, at least at that point, you mentioned he was far and away a top 12 player at that point. Keegan Bradley did not do a whole lot post-Travelers to sort of justify and warrant picking himself. So I actually thought it was the right move. I don't think he would have been a big enough difference maker inside the ropes to sort of to go on one side where, you know, he has to be a player. And he would be such a difference maker that whatever he does captaincy-wise would be overshadowed by that. And so I was fine with that. I was fine with the lead up into the Ryder Cup. I thought it made a lot of sense on a lot of fronts. The week of, though, couldn't have gone much worse. You look at what the setup was. You look at the bickering now between Justin Thomas and the Bethpage golf course setup crew about green speeds. You look at cutting the rough. You look at the data, and Harris English and Colin Morikawa were quite literally the worst possible analytical pairing according to Data Golf. And they didn't send them out just once. They send them out twice after getting beat roundly in foursomes. Keegan Bradley, I think, did not do a good enough job of tamping down what was a vicious, vitriolic crowd towards Rory McIlroy and a lot of the Europeans. Will he get another shot? Keegan Bradley certainly sounds like he wants one. Tiger Woods said last week at the Hero World Challenge, he has not been contacted by anyone at the PGA of America. Brant Snedeker, he's the President's Cup captain. Do you have him pull double duty? He'd still be a first-time captain. Stuart Sink would be a first-time captain. Matt Kuchar would be a first-time captain. There's no real obvious choices as the Americans try to win for the first time since 1993. I don't know where Team USA goes, but it is a little bit messy. How about number three newsmaker, Rex? That is Brian Rolapp, the new CEO of the PGA Tour. It was announced in June. We have not seen or heard all that much from him in the past 6 months, but it's pretty clear that his impact is already being felt at HQ.
And I can't overstate how much of a sea change this is for the PGA Tour. And it, you not only rollout, but just the idea that the PGA Tour is now a for-profit. And whatever the romantic ideas of what you thought the PGA Tour was before as a charity, as someone who did good in the community, those have sailed. Bye-bye, nice moment. That's not an option anymore. And I'm not even being critical of that. I think in this moment in time, and I've said this before, and I'll continue to say it, I'm not quite sure who's qualified to negotiate a billion-dollar international deal as it applies to LIV Golf and the Public Investment Fund. However, Brian Rolapp seems like the guy I would want in that chair. By all accounts, you talk to anybody who's either met him or known him from his past life in the NFL. He's really good at all the things the PGA Tour needs right now, and that is a for-profit model. That's someone who understands that the investors, SSG and private equity, not want a return on their investment. They're going to get a return on their investment. So that means the PGA Tour model has to move around quite a bit. I will say that Brian has done a really good job of being in that chair for the first few months. He sort of consolidated all the people around him. Most importantly, Tiger Woods. He made Tiger Woods the chair of this future competitions committee, and he put him in charge of the idea of what the PGA Tour should become from a competitive model to make it a better business model. That was brilliant. If for no other reason than whatever Tiger says in a room, and there was a meeting in the Bahamas during the Hero World Challenge, and Brian Rolapp ran that meeting, he made the presentation to all the players in the field at Albany, but it was Tiger Woods who was standing behind him and answering questions occasionally. And that's the person that Brian had to have behind him. But make no mistake, Brian Rolapp is very much a New York NFL shield person. This is all about profit. This is all about making the product as good as you possibly can make it on the field. And the idea that the PGA Tour is going to be this mom and pop shop that goes to these small markets and is a big influence in these little tiny towns, that's not going to happen anymore. I was told on numerous occasions that the PGA Tour is in 5 of the top 30 markets right now in the United States. That's not sustainable, and that's not going to be the future.
Yeah, and look, that's why I think that this is a really exciting time to follow this tour, because you are bringing in, as you mentioned, a golf outsider from the strongest and most powerful entity in the American sports market. And Brian Rolapp is not promising little nip and tucks. Like, this is a full cosmetic makeover. These are seismic changes, even if you could argue, Rex, whether that's actually needed. Right now, you have sponsors who are more than willing to pay for tournaments basically every single week of the entire calendar. What Brian Rolapp is promising to do is going to be disruptive. Players might and probably will balk at some of his ideas. Sponsors and tournament directors and media partners are probably going to get squeezed by what is going to unfold over the next couple months and the next couple of years. But Brian Rolapp has already demonstrated, in at least the limited front-facing roles that we have seen him, to be a really impressive leader who is laying out a vision who, yes, you could quibble with some of the details. It does make some sense with the tenets that he is promising, with simplicity and parity and scarcity for what the tour can and should transform into. My question for you is, this is a player-run organization with the PGA Tour. This is a tour now that has financial backing from the Strategic Sports Group, which had a $1.5 billion, that's, yes, with a B, investment. How much power does Brian Rolapp actually have in terms of transforming the PGA Tour into his vision?
Oh, I think alongside Tiger Woods, he's the ultimate power. SSG picked him. Arthur Blank, who was on the search committee, essentially hand-picked him simply because of the work.
The owner of the Falcons. Yeah.
Owner of the Falcons. He's a member of the SSG group that, as you pointed out, invested $1.5 billion. This is an important element. They went out of their way to make sure they had their guy and that job. And you go back to Brian Rolapp's job to do an origin story here. He did all the things at the NFL that the PGA Tour really needs right now. New media rights deals where you maximize the product, just not on TV, but across all the platforms, because you and I both have talked about this. The landscape is going to change very, very quickly for all of sports, just not golf. And I believe professional golf is a little bit behind on this front. So he's the right guy on that front. He also ran all of the investments for the NFL. The idea that he was the guy that took all the money from the guys who have the money and invested it in the things he thought was important. He now has $1.5 billion to do that for the PGA Tour. He alluded to this in the first press conference, in the first chance I had to talk with him at the Travelers Championship when he was introduced as the new CEO, where that's the part that intrigued him the most, because he's got ideas. He hasn't spent a lot of time talking about it, but he's got ideas on this front. On the other side of it, in speaking with players this week and over the last few weeks, there's going to be some winners and some losers. There's probably going to be a lot of losers in this scenario. If the schedule, as scarcity indicates, is going to be condensed, and that seems to be where they're headed right now, that means fewer playing opportunities. That means fewer spots for players on the PGA Tour. Whatever it is they create below the PGA Tour might be a good product, might be a place where you can develop your game, might be a place where you can make a decent living while you try to get to that next level. But there's going to be plenty of people who are hurt by this, not just players, but tournaments. If the PGA Tour schedule is going to go to 20 events, which I'm just throwing that number out there because that seems to be the popular one right now, that means roughly 20 events are going somewhere else, either away or to another tour. These are events that have been on the schedule for a long time. I'm not going to pick one out to pick on them, but you can sit and kind of go down the schedule yourself and decide exactly which events, yep, that looks like scarcity to me. I'm not exactly sure what it looks like, but if I look in the dictionary, that tournament is probably what it looks like. You're right. He's going to break a lot of eggs, to use Tiger Woods' terms, but most people, the people that seem to matter, feel like he's the right guy to do it.
Yeah, look, a new core tour product is really exciting if you can maximize the schedule between the Super Bowl and Labor Day. Best field, best courses, best times in the schedule. Like, I think all of that makes sense. The questions, though, are numerous. Middle class, what happens in the fall and winter? There's always this comp to the NFL and football. But you look at the NFL is trying to expand. The NFL dominates the landscape calendar year round with the draft and OTAs and free agency. The like, they are still in the conversation. They don't just disappear for 4 or 5 months. So how the PGA Tour can, yes, have this core product, but still have a foothold, still sort of satiate the hardcore golf fan, I think is the biggest question as we move towards 2026 with the planned rollout for 2027. More to say on this in 2026 for sure. The prize pony of the PGA Tour in 2025 most definitely was our number two newsmaker. That is Scottie Scheffler. Two more major championships in 2025 puts him up to four overall. He's now just one away from the career Grand Slam that he can complete next year at the U.S. Open at Shinnecock. Six PGA Tour titles overall for Scottie Rex in 2025. He didn't get arrested, but he did have a bizarre hand injury last Christmas that slowed his role a little bit during the spring. What was your takeaway from Scottie's year?
You're going to get so mad at me because I'm going to do the Monday morning quarterbacking thing. And I expect a mean emoji to spit my way from you really, really quick. I think Scottie being number two is too high. And that, there's no disrespect to Scottie, the ballot.
Too high or too low?
Well, it shouldn't be two. It should be closer to five than two, if that makes sense. Whichever way you,
wow,
you find that. Only because, and to like hear me out on this one, only because Scottie Scheffler, not only does he not like to make headlines, he really doesn't make headlines. And I'll go back to the idea that you're right. Last year was an entirely different scenario. Not only was he a dominant player on the golf course, but you had a lot of things that oddly went on off the golf course, specifically at the PGA Championship when he got arrested, the last person in the world you would have thought to get arrested. The ballot for the PGA Tour Player of the Year just came out last week, and there was four candidates, which I thought was a little weird because it really just should be one. It should be Scottie, as you pointed out. Six wins, two majors, the PGA Championship and the Open Championship, to put him right there on the threshold of winning the career Grand Slam. You look at what he did statistically. He was asked in the Bahamas if there was any stats that he looks at that sort of stood out. And he, in typical Scottie fashion, he just rolled his eyes and said, absolutely not. So I'll fill in the blanks. First, strokes gained approach. First, strokes gained tee to green. First, strokes gained total. First, scoring average. And by a long shot, Roy McIlroy is number two on that list, and he's almost a full stroke better than Rory. He's first in points in the regular season. He's first on the world golf ranking. He is by far the best player in the game right now. There is no doubt about it, but he's also not a guy that likes to make headlines. Like when he started his season on the injured list because of some sort of bizarre cooking accident, that was the headline that he made. And so he is one of those types of guys, and I keep going back to the idea that he would be a perfect quarterback for an NFL team because he's the smiling face of your franchise. He's really good, and he never says anything out of step. He never goes out of his way. I asked him in the Bahamas about these changes to the PGA Tour, and he just kind of shrugged. Well, I'm going to play whatever they tell me to play. I love to compete. And that's sort of where he comes from. He's brilliant. He's the best player on the PGA Tour right now. I would argue the best player on the planet right now, but he's not the number two newsmaker. I'm sorry.
Look, he's better statistically in 2025 than he was in 2024 when he won 9 times overall. And I can't help but wonder if we'll look back in 5 or 10 years and realize like we're taking for granted how special Scottie Scheffler actually is. Like he's got 13 PGA Tour wins in the last two seasons. He's finished top 10 in all but 6 events the last 2 years. His top 10 percentage in his career is now over 50%. He's already up to nearly $100 million in career earnings. But you might say, yeah, but the PGA Tour is diluted now. Ever since LIV came along, you know, they've taken some of the best players, John Rahm, Brooks Koepka, Dustin Johnson, whatever. Scottie Scheffler has now won all 4 of his major championships by at least 3 shots. Those are supposed to be all of the best players under one roof competing, and Scottie Scheffler is blowing them away. He's the only player in the modern era to accomplish that. This year alone, Rex, with those 2 major titles, he won them so differently. At Quail Hollow for the PGA, remember he had a really shoddy opening 9 in that final round, actually let the lead slip away to John Rahm. What does he do on the back 9? Complete, flawless demonstration of skill. The exact same thing he did on Saturday to build a nice cushion. The Open, I thought, was sort of a monument to his excellence and his unrelenting brilliance. A few days after telling the reporters, you say he doesn't say anything interesting, that press conference before Port Rush was super, super interesting, where he was saying that golf is not his be-all and end-all and how little it actually matters to him in the grand scheme of things. Well, winning a major championship still matters a whole hell of a lot. Top 7 in every major, top 4 in every playoff event, the best player by far, the only stain, the only negative for Scottie Scheffler in 2025, was that Ryder Cup performance, going 0-4 in the team sessions. The only American ever to do that in the Ryder Cup. Yes, he was not quite as dark and bleak and dire as Keegan Bradley was, but he was certainly disappointed by that. You may disagree with this. If you do, let us know in the YouTube comment section. But that leads us, Rex, to our number one newsmaker of 2025. In my opinion, no surprise, it was the year of Rory McIlroy. It may not have been his best year statistically, but it certainly was his most personally significant, wasn't it?
Again, this is not deciding who the best player was on the planet. That was Scottie Scheffler. This is not about this. This is about newsmakers. This is about the people that we spent the vast majority of the year talking about. And I don't even think anybody is particularly close on this front when it comes to Rory McIlroy. As I just said, the Jack Nicklaus trophy that goes to the PGA Tour Player of the Year, that's Scottie's. They should just send it to him right now. They don't have to wait until December 12th for the vote. He's going to be the player of the year. Now, you and I are proud members of the Golf Writers Association of America. We, too, give out a male player.
Oh, Presidente.
And Vice Presidente. Thank you very much. We give out a male player of the year as well. And I think if you look at the totality of what he did this season around the globe, just not on the PGA Tour, 3-time winner on the PGA Tour, including the Players Championship, which was a really cool finish on Monday. I think we're going to talk a little bit about that in the show. And then the Masters, we're going to talk a lot about that in the show. I'm not going to belabor the point. We all know how special that was at Augusta National to complete the career Grand Slam, to finally get the green jacket, all the emotions, everything that went into that. But then you look beyond that. He won the Irish Open, which for him, being from Ireland, is the 5th major. That one's really important to him. He won his 7th DP World Tour title. That put him really on the doorstep of being the all-time greatest European, right behind Colin Montgomery right now in that category. And he also endured the slings and arrows of the worst fans you could possibly imagine at Bethpage to essentially lead the European team to victory after you and I and everyone else in golf media probably spent the better part of 2 months talking about Rory's going to go into a slump. Like after he wins the Masters, of course, he got to the top of the mountain. He's going to take a second to exhale. Let's give him his accolades. Let's allow him to do this. He did not do that. And in the midst of that, he decided at the end of the year, instead of going and sitting on his couch comfortably and enjoying what he did, to take the game globally, to do this celebration tour around the globe in India and in Australia to finish the year. We talk all the time about players trying to grow the game. I feel like Rory is actually doing it. So if you look at the context, just not the box scores of what Rory McIlroy did this year. In my mind, he's the easy newsmaker.
Yeah, look, Rory McIlroy cemented his legacy as one of the greatest ever. Full stop. And the Masters victory, and to me, the fitting manner in which he won at Augusta National with all that drama, Actually, in hindsight, that win makes all of the other achievements that he has had in his brilliant career, like, it makes them seem even bigger. It fills out his resume even more. All the weeks at world number one, all the other majors, the FedEx Cup titles, the Race to Dubai titles, as you mentioned, the 29 PGA Tour wins, all the other times, more than 20 around the world. And look, you mentioned the lull that he had post-Masters, which is very human behavior. That was certainly understandable. He will now take that time during this quote-unquote offseason and set other goals for the rest of his career. And he's already outlined a couple of them. He's still 36 years old. He's still in great shape. He wants to prioritize the National Opens because, just like the one in Australia, they mean a little bit more. There's upcoming majors in 2027 at Pebble Beach in St. Andrews. Those major venues, no offense to the others, just mean a little bit more. Winning at some of the cathedrals of the game, as the USGA likes to call them. Olympic gold is still out there for him to potentially achieve in 2028. There's enough carrots to keep him going, but I continue, Rex, to go back to the Ryder Cup and the manner in which he called his shot. He pounded the table in Rome and said, "We are going to win at Bethpage," and he backed it up, going 3-0-1 in team play while enduring the most vicious abuse ever in the Ryder Cup. To me, might have been, I know the Masters was phenomenal, and that sort of stamps his legacy as the sixth player ever to complete the career Grand Slam. That was like the perfect coda to his year, don't you think?
I do. And to your point, he also said in that press conference in Rome that that was the hardest thing to do in sports. That was a mountain that he wanted to get to. You have to appreciate, I think your words, to call his shot. You have to appreciate the idea that he understood how difficult this was going to be. And he took it all. You and I both walked with him, especially on Saturday at the Ryder Cup at Bethpage. That is as bad as I've ever seen fan behavior. And I'm not trying to make excuses for the New York crowds. They were doing this for a number of reasons, not the least of which is that they're from New York. But they had reason to do it, just not that far. They clearly took it too far. I think both teams and everyone involved has agreed with that. But he shouldered it all. He didn't shy away from any of it. He didn't try to pretend like, no, this isn't a big deal. Not only did he shoulder it, but he really put a lot of bass in his voice in doing it.
Yeah, look, I still think one of the most enduring moments of the year for me at the end of a long year for Roy McIlroy was Luke Donald in that winning press conference talking about Roy McIlroy's sacrifice and how it's such a model for the team that you have a player who has achieved so much in the game who still wants to devote so much of himself to these team events. And Roy was just sitting there nodding with tears streaming down his face because he has accomplished more than anyone on that stage combined. And yet even he understood it is more satisfying to do it together. All right. Those are our newsmakers. After a short break, we're going to be handing out awards for the 2025 season. Stick around. Okay, Rex, we did this for the PGA Tour wrap-up show, but now we're casting a wider net for the entirety of 2025 with these awards. What was the best shot of the year?
This one was pretty easy. As soon as you sent the list out, I knew exactly where I was going to go, but I don't know if you do this. I immediately went to the internet and pulled up the video, and I was so mesmerized, I probably watched it another 10 times just because I was like, that's really cool. It was Rory's 7-iron around the trees on the 15th hole on Sunday at the Masters. And not only was it a brilliant shot, I suggest everyone please go to YouTube, take a look at it, because it's so phenomenal. Everything about it, just the situation, how he executed the shot, how he walked it off, sort of his expression when he got to the green. Keep in mind, he had just played his last two holes in double bogey, bogey, and he was tied for the lead at this point. And you were thinking to yourself in real time that, oh boy, Rory's going to Rory again at the Masters. This is going to be an epic collapse. And as members of the media, you and I both were probably thinking how we were going to write that story. And he had to do exactly what you would expect a Masters champion to do. I always go back to the Phil Mickelson line that he told Bones McKay that year when he had to hit the shot between the trees on the 13th hole, that I'm going to have to hit a heroic shot to win the Masters. I'm going to have to pull off something special. And I truly believe this was Rory's something special. He did make the eagle putt. And I know this is always the argument that, well, if he did make the putt, the shot wasn't special. He two putted, he took the lead, he never looked back.
That was too easy. You're too basic. I'm going a little bit deeper. I'm going JJ Spahn's drive on the 71st and 72nd holes of the US Open. And maybe, Rex, is just because I'm currently in the throes of the driver yips, as I've talked about on this podcast. But it is almost inconceivable to me how JJ Spahn thread the needle on that drivable short 17th, where there was so much potential disaster. Keep in mind what happened to Tyrrell Hatton about a half hour earlier, where his chances to win the U.S. Open were thrown away around that bunker. Hitting it to 20 feet to set up a two-putt birdie, then steps up and pipes it down the middle on the treacherous 18th hole, where if you miss right, stats, data, analytics, they all showed it was essentially a one-shot penalty if you missed in that thick right rough for J.J. Spaun to put it in the middle of the fairway, hit it to about 60 feet, and yes, pour in the birdie putt to win his first major championship. To me, that was incredible for a guy who hadn't been there before.
If we're going to do these lists based on what we can and can't do well on the golf course, does that mean Todd Lewis is going to pick his best shot of the year, someone who hit an unbelievable chip shot? Because we all know he can't chips. And that clearly means that I should have picked a driver as well.
It doesn't even need to be a chip shot. It could just be like a standard run-of-the-mill pitch and run.
Just a pitch and run. Something easy.
Would not be able to accomplish it. Rex, how about most dramatic moment? Obviously, Rory had a bunch. What was yours?
Yeah, the Rory moment coming up the hill at the Masters is going to be in a category by itself. But I went back to the Ryder Cup on Sunday afternoon, and I am a rational person. I tried to look at things very clearly and try not to turn them into something they're not. I don't like to get hyperbole into the mix. I like to stay in the moment. And the journalist in me would tell you on Sunday afternoon as those singles matches progressed that, no, Europe's still going to win. It doesn't matter what the United States is doing. But you and I both were looking at each other as more and more and more U.S. flags kept going on the board. And at some point, even I lapsed into the idea that maybe this could actually happen. They had to be perfect coming down the stretch. They ended up not being perfect, meaning they had to essentially win the last six matches, I believe, if I remember the situation correctly. They could not give one away. They couldn't give a half point away. And for Shane Lowry to stand on the 18th green, and he clearly knew the situation. He clearly knows what this means. You dream about things as a professional golfer. Shane Lowry winning the Open Championship at Port Rush is clearly going to be at the top of his list when it comes to professional moments. Either clenching that Ryder Cup in that moment with everything that was going on and knowing that it seemed like it was over, but if I don't do this, it might not be over. That, to me, was the moment of the year.
So that's really funny because I'm sticking with that match, but I'm going about 15 minutes earlier. And I went back and I watched the YouTube video to make sure I had all the details right. So it was 13.5 to 10.5 Europe over the U.S. There were four matches left on the golf course. Russell Henley was one up as he faced a putt on 17. Ben Griffin was one up on 16. Then two others were a coin flip and tied with four to go. So like the pucker factor was obviously very, very real. We were on the verge, Rex, of witnessing quite possibly the most unlikely comeback in sports history. This would even blow out the Falcons 28-3 over the Patriots at that point. So Russell Henley is standing on 17 green. He has a chance to put another point on the board for the Americans. Everyone is gathered around that 17th hole to see if he can do it. Because at that point, it would almost be in the Americans' favor to stage this improbable rally and get to 14.5. And what does Russell Henley do in that moment? With a 10-footer to win the match, he leaves it short. He heads to 18, one up, misses it again, leaves it a little bit weak, and Shane Lowry, as you mentioned, pours it in, and the entire crowd goes berserk, and the Europeans retain the putt. But that moment, Russell Henley lining up and stroking the putt on 17, we have the exact same moment. We have the exact same match. Mine just happened 15 minutes earlier. That's a little bit funny. All right, how about biggest overachiever? America is still laughing that you put Ben Griffin as your top newcomer, despite him just completing his third full season on the PGA Tour. Who's your biggest overachiever, though?
Ben Griffin. Good guess. Way to do it. And look, this is really easy. In the span of essentially 4 years, he went from selling mortgages. I still think it's so funny that someone always looks up at the TV and went, honey, is that the guy that sold us a mortgage? That guy, the guy that's holding the trophy. He went from selling mortgages, sitting in an office, having given up on his pro dreams, to clearly being a middle of the pack PGA Tour player, to three PGA Tour wins, starting in the Ryder Cup, being a budding star on the PGA Tour. That is, by definition, an overachiever. I don't want to dismiss what Ben did here. I think it's amazing when you look at where he was essentially at this point last year. Like, he needed a good fall to set himself up for what he ended up doing this season on the PGA Tour. He got into those first two signature events and then just got on a roll. I also love the idea that in real time, watching what transpired between winning the team event in New Orleans alongside Andrew Novak, and that clearly was the boost he needed, to suddenly putting himself into contention at the Colonial and put himself into contention at the PGA Championship. He wins Colonial, doesn't win the PGA Championship, but it transformed him from a player who was middle of the pack that probably at one point thought that I'm never going to have the opportunity to follow up on this dream, to thinking that, man, I can go on and do something special. He ended up winning three times on the PGA Tour this year. I pointed out, I would argue, one of the few bright spots on that U.S. team at the Ryder Cup. I would say him and J.J. Spahn were pretty much it. I think that is the definition of going from an underachiever to an overachiever.
Yeah, look, I was poking fun, but I do think Ben Griffin is the obvious choice here. I actually went, you mentioned him, I went with Ben Griffin's partner at the Zurich Classic with Andrew Novak. He started the year today, Andrew Novak, number 123 in the official world golf ranking, ended it as roughly a top 30 player with two PGA Tour titles to his credit, just like Ben Griffin did, playing well in the fall to sort of springboard him into a successful 2025. Andrew Novak shows what's possible with good play and the parity that still exists on the PGA Tour. He played well at Torrey Pines. That got him into Pebble Beach. He played well at Pebble Beach. That got him into Riviera. And all of a sudden, he was off and running. I don't know what the future holds for Andrew Novak. I don't know if he's going to become a household name or a big star on the PGA Tour, but he is exactly what you want to see if you're a Brian Rolup. You want to provide pathways. You want to provide opportunities for players to change and alter their career trajectory. Andrew Novak, Ben Griffin, both prime examples of that in 2025. On the other end of the spectrum, Rex, how about biggest underachiever, players who disappointed? Who's your pick?
Now, this is going to, please don't live. Just don't stay away from me on social media. God. I don't feel like getting, here it goes. You know where I'm going with this. It's Jon Rahm, and I'm going to give him his flowers first. Look, he was very consistent on LIV Golf again, as he has been the last few years. And it's been impressive. He had some decent finishes in the major championships, but he is still winless in the events that matter, the majors, since he joined LIV Golf. I'm not blaming it on LIV Golf. Maybe 54 holes and loud music and shorts aren't his thing, and maybe going to 72 holes is going to be that tonic that allows him to click back in and being that world-class player that we expected him to be. But when he left the PGA Tour, he was 1A, 1B, somewhere along there, alongside Scottie Scheffler. It was him and Scottie at that time. Look, Rory was a very close second, but it was Jon Rahm and Scottie Scheffler at that point in the game. That simply hasn't been the case, and maybe it's because he's not preparing the way he used to in LIV Golf events. Maybe he's just at a different stage in his life. Maybe this was inevitable, that maybe he had gotten to the point where there is an ebb and flow to every PGA Tour career. Maybe this was just one of those flows or ebbs. However, there's no denying the fact that he underachieved since he's been at LIV, and he's still underachieved this year.
Absolutely zero respect for LIV's individual season-long title. You hate to see it, folks. Back-to-back titles for Jon Rahm in that respect. I understand what you're saying. And look, Data Golf still has him very highly ranked among the top players in the world. He did still finish top 15 in three of the major championships. But I'm with you. It's not just that he's not winning major championships. He's not winning many golf tournaments, period, on LIV Golf or otherwise. For him not to do so against short fields was a pretty big head-scratcher for me. Again, I think the move to 72 holes is going to make a big, big difference in terms of Jon Rahm's, not just his performance on LIV. I would be shocked if he doesn't win two or three times at least on that circuit with the move to semi-tools. I just think it's better preparation overall and the way they'd like to play golf. I'm actually going to keep it on LIV for my biggest underachiever. And to me, that player was Brooks Koepka. For the first time in his career, he missed the cut in three major championships. Yes, he was top 12 at the U.S. Open, but that was also after a retreat, after being very much in the mix over the first 36 holes. He's about to turn 36. He's got a battered body. He has a major deficiency with his putting. I know late in the season, he showed a little bit of signs of life. The French Open, the Dunhill Links as well. But mostly, he has become a forgotten man at the major championships. And to me, that is a sad thing for a major hunter like Brooks Koepka. How about a newcomer? You cannot say Ben Griffin. A newcomer, Rex, who is most likely to stick around and succeed.
Now, this is a second-year tour player, so I expect you're going to be just as critical as you That's were fine. With Ben Griffin. But Michael Thor Bjornsson, and I say that only because he got put himself into contention at the RSM Classic a few weeks ago, had a chance to spend some time with him and talk about his season. And he dealt with injury. There was things that going on off the golf course that clearly impacted his play. But you look at the way he ended up finishing the year. He had six top 25 finishes in his last 11 starts. Again, put himself into contention at the last event in the year, squarely in the hunt to get into those signature events. And he does the one thing you have to do really well on the PGA Tour. He's seventh this season on tour in strokes gained off the tee. And this goes to the conversation we just had about Ben Griffin. This goes to the conversation I wanted to add about Andrew Novak. The idea that not only is he a star in the making, but he's also a great personality in the making. I had a chance to spend some time with him at the RSM Classic. If you want to listen to a good NFL podcast, look, I'm not trying to drive people away from our podcast, but Andrew Novak's NFL podcast is really good. I had the chance to spend some time listening to it. I would put Michael in that category. He's an interesting person to hear talk about the game. He looks at things a little bit differently than some of the other players of maybe that class. You covered him in college. No one does it better than you at the college level. You understood how much talent he had coming out. But I love his game, and I love the way he's trending in the right direction.
Goldie, find the tapes. Michael Thorbjornsson was my newcomer to watch at the end of 2024. As I always say, Rex, we're never wrong, just early. There's so many other players.
Your player of the year, the last 3 years, has been Xander Schauffele. How are you doing on that front?
Like the last eight. I'm still like 0 for 8 for that one. I love the Thor pick. I love Marco Penge's game and what he did in 2025. Aldrich Potgieter winner on the PGA Tour. Johnny Kiefer, great year on the Korn Ferry Tour. Neil Shipley, Michael Brennan, Jackson Koivin, who I mentioned the PGA Tour show. I think all of those players are good picks. For me, the player who I think has the best chance to stick is David Puge. He's just 23 years old. He won the Australian PGA a couple of weeks ago. He already has 3 worldwide victories, tons and tons of firepower off the tee, averages more than 325 off the tee, coupled that with a very slick short game and putter. I watched him climb the ranks in college at Arizona State, completely blown away by his talent. Yes, it's taken him a few years to sort of find his footing. He was among that initial wave of players who committed to live back in 2022. Big, big, big believer in his talent. I think he's a future European Ryder Cup player. All right, finally, Rex, our awards. On a personal note, what were your favorite memories or memory from the year covering golf?
So I danced around favorite moment, whatever the case may be, and I danced around the idea of what Rory was able to accomplish on Sunday at the Masters. And again, I would strongly recommend that if you want something to close the year in golf, just go and watch not anything he did during the round of golf, but his walk up the hill, because I'm not quite sure there was better TV in the world of golf this year on the PGA Tour, and I'm not quite sure there was a better moment as far as personally what it meant to him. The way you just saw the emotions, you saw the stress, you saw the weight of having to win that green jacket to try to complete the career Grand Slam just come melting off him as he walked up the hill towards the clubhouse. The way the fans embraced him, essentially carrying him up the hill, the way he really allowed himself to be vulnerable in that moment. It just wasn't crying. It was ugly crying. He was trying to catch his breath. This is the type of stuff that you can't fake. The idea that, okay, I'm just going to open it up because I've been holding it off. And he had. Do you hear him talk after the fact and even leading in to that Masters? He had done everything in his power to dance around how important this was. He tried, his schedule was different. He tried to ignore the outside noise. He tried to embrace the outside noise. He watched TV. He didn't watch TV for a decade. He tried every formula he possibly could. And in that moment, you saw how much it meant to him.
I think it was 7 minutes and the TV announcers did not utter one sentence.
Brilliant TV.
Yet it was captivating television. Such a human story of trying and failing over and over again and finally getting it done. Certainly a lesson to be learned there. Mine, and people always are sort of mystified when I say that my favorite tournament to cover is the Open Championship. It's the only tournament where you can see players like Ryan Fox and John Rahm pull up to the Harbor Bar in Portrush for a pint of Guinness. You have the variable weather. We always poke fun at the weather forecast and how wrong or how right they end up being. The different challenge of playing links golf, the crowd this year in particular trying to will their hometown son, Roy McIlroy, across the finish line, waiting as Roy McIlroy did for Harry Diamond to finish raking the bunker on 72, so they could walk together to the 72nd hole and feel that warm embrace. I absolutely loved this year's Open Championship. It's my favorite tournament to cover. If I could only cover one all year long, it would be that one. This Open in particular was very, very poignant and very, very special. All right, that's a wrap up for the awards. When we come back, some final thoughts and a quick look ahead to 2026. Stick around. All right, Rex, let's close out this year-end edition with some deep thoughts heading into the offseason. What's on your mind?
I think I'm going to look ahead to 2026. And I think you and I both understand how pivotal next year is going to be. You're going to have the constants. We're still going to be talking about Scottie Scheffler being brilliant. We're still going to talk about Rory McIlroy and his impact on the game. We're probably going to talk about slow play and everything else we end up touching on over the course of the year. But I think we're going to learn exactly what Brian Rolapp's plan is for the PGA Tour. We're going to learn exactly what that looks like. We're also going to learn if the Public Investment Fund of Saudi Arabia is willing to double down. Everybody knows there's some big contracts coming due at the end of next year. Bryson DeChambeau, Brooks Koepka. Are they going to go ahead and stay at the table? Are they going to decide to go all in with their chips? Because if they don't, then that's essentially throwing up the white flag. And we're going to see who takes the next step. And that's always the fun part. You and I love talking about the Scottie Schefflers and the Rory McIlroys and the Xander Schauffeles of the world. But it is those young players that seem to come along every single year that open eyes. I mean, at the end of this year, you and I spent a lot of time talking about Michael Brennan and what he was able to do in just his third PGA Tour start. That, to me, is what makes the game special.
Yeah, look, on the PGA Tour side, like, the rumor mill is just going to be churning over the first couple of months of 2026 as they formulate a plan. It's a really fun exercise, not just for us, but the entire golf world, to sort of map out what a possible future for the tour is going to look like, weighing the various pros and cons. I think it does require a lot of faith and a lot of trust. And at least on the player side, that's been in short supply since the secretive framework agreement. But at some point, the players are going to have to put aside their selfish interests for a better today and a better tomorrow. But I certainly think it could get very messy in the interim. All right, as we close out this podcast, a huge thank you to everybody for a great year on the channel and on the show. Special shout out to our producers, Goldie and Dom, Fred on the ones and twos, just the countless hours that he has devoted to getting this show on television. Rex, do you have any special holiday wishes for the people watching at home?
No, it's been an exciting year. You and I got to do this for linear TV on Sunday nights going into Mondays, and it's been an eye-opening experience. I think you and I both have learned, and we've enjoyed all of the feedback. That's the part I think I enjoy the absolute most. And I do want to point real quickly to the idea that we did this at the end of last year, and I don't think either one of us predicted that Scottie Scheffler was going to cut his hand open on a wine glass trying to make ravioli. I don't think either one of us predicted how emotional the Masters would be. So I can only look forward to what's going to be next.
Yeah, we've got some exciting plans underway next year for even more on YouTube and social media. So get ready for that. In the meantime, happy holidays. We'll see you in 2026.